Okay, we'll get this session started. This is session 138 of our Professional Learning Community Conference Calls. We call it PLC, the Environmental Workforce Development Job Training Professional Learning Community. This week we're supposed to talk about recruitment, which is really probably one of the most important aspects of job training program. But before we go there, because of the time of the year and what's coming up, I need to tell you a little bit about working on the RFP, the Request for Proposals from EPA. Normally, our calls are to assist communities, new grantees and existing grantees make their programs the best they can as a technical assistance role. Let me tell you a little bit about HMTRI. We work with EPA under a cooperative agreement that's not associated with the job training program, and our role is to help new communities or communities decide if they want to develop an environmental workforce development job training program. Once those communities decide they may want to do this, we provide technical assistance and mentoring to help them get their program going. If they are fortunate enough to get assistance from the Environmental Protection Agency under an Environmental Workforce Development Job Training Grant, we help them to make the best of their funds and programs through mentoring and collaboration. We hold an annual grantee meeting every August in Alexandria where we get together EPA staff, mentors, all the grantees and communities that are very close to developing a program or maybe have a program that is not funded by EPA. And we also have past alumni, people who may not be under a grant at this time, but maybe getting funds from other programs or working on their own to develop environmental job training programs. In every case, what we do is bring people together, collaborate, try to work out the best strategies possible, whether it's recruitment, placement, curriculum, student services. We try to exchange ideas to see what works for each group, and every community is different, so it helps to hear from other people. And we have a wide variety of strategies, curriculum, target groups, employers all across the country. We've been doing this for about 15 years since the beginning of the program. That's who we are. We don't speak for EPA. We're not EPA. We just are technical assistance providers, a nonprofit organization trying to bring people together and collaborate and exchange ideas. So anything we say has nothing to do with policy or any of our grantees or contributors to these calls. We meet every other week. Right now we're on a holiday schedule. We'll be meeting today. We'll be meeting again next week on the 16th of December. Then we'll take a holiday break and meet again on the 6th of January before the proposals for environmental workforce programs are due. What's very important I would like to announce is that EPA is having their second webinar tomorrow, December 10th, 2 p.m. It will be a repeat of the first one, but there may be additional information and additional opportunities to ask questions that may not have occurred on the first webinar. It's open to everyone. You don't need to sign up. And I'll put in the presentation notes for this conference call the website to go to the webinar. And once you're at the webinar site, the Adobe site, you can also download reference materials, PowerPoints, and frequently asked questions. So that's all happening tomorrow. I encourage everyone to attend the webinar. And I would also suggest you get questions ready. If you have specific questions about the RFP or other questions you may want it clarified, I would write them down and see if they are not answered during the presentation or question period that you bring them up. I think the issue that we're getting the most questions about and concern is the issues on page 12. It has to do with curriculum. EPA operates primarily out of the Brownfields program. Brownfields has its waste assessment and cleanup training, which also includes petroleum cleanup. And they contribute about $3.3 million to this program to fund about 17 grants every year. It's been reoccurring. That number goes up and down. But in addition to that, other offices at EPA have been interested in additional training. Solid waste management cleanup, for example, is contributing $10,000. Superfund site cleanup and innovative and alternative treatment technologies is contributing $25,000. Wastewater treatment, $47,000. Emergency planning, $20,000. And this goes on. Health and safety, $10,000. Pest management, $10,000. Alternative energy technologies, $15,000. But the lion's amount of funding is coming from Brownfields Hazardous Waste Assessment. This is different this year than other years, than any other year, in that the question occurs is, should the training be proportionate to the funding? For example, should pest control, for example, receive lots of training while only contributing $10,000 to a budget over $3 million. So I think that, in my opinion, they decided to try to relate the funding levels to the training levels of the program, and it may encourage people to contribute more funding in the future. In any case, what's happening this year is that when proposals are accepted, the amount of funding will be proportional to the training budgets. And again, what's different in this RFP is you have to assign the training expenditures in your program for each of these particular categories, each of these offices. When they run out of money or once it's allocated, they're going to not be able to fund any more of those particular types of training. For example, once they run out of wastewater treatment training money, $47,000, they can't support additional programs. So if you have a program, for example, that's heavily dependent on pest management, and there's only $10,000 to be divided up amongst the 17 grantees, they can perhaps fund one program or maybe spread that out amongst the awareness training for several grantees. But those proposals that have much more, that funding will not be appropriated. So the bottom line of this is, in my opinion, the largest proportion of your training should be in the Brownfields Hazardous Waste Assessment cleanup training, which includes petroleum cleanup training, because that's where most of the money is coming from. Other funding certainly can be addressed and supported by the program, primarily in, I would say, in awareness training. There's quite a larger pot of money for wastewater treatment and Superfund site cleanup, and some renewable energy training, which is $15,000. But I would be cautioning anyone to base their whole program on curriculum and certifications that are directed at something that is not contributing a lot to the overall funding of the program. Because if they pull it, you'll lose your program, or they may not be able to fund your entire program. So this is something that they're going to be working through this year. It's somewhat confusing. It's understandable why it's happening, but it poses additional challenges this year. With that in mind, I think it's important, too, that during questions, if you have a question on curriculum that you may be proposing and how that curriculum relates to these particular funding levels, it's something you may want to bring up in the webinar tomorrow. If you miss that, you may want to talk to your regional coordinator so you can get some direction specifically so you're very clear. It would be a shame to write a proposal and put the effort into it and misdirect your curriculum that doesn't align with the ability to fund that curriculum. So having said that, one other thing I want to talk to before we get to recruitment are these global issues concerning development of your overall strategy, your environmental workforce development strategy. And the reason I'm bringing this up is what I'm about to talk about takes a lot of time. Now, we've been holding professional learning communities all year, every other week. And many of you who have been on many of the calls are quite aware of everything I'm saying. But for those of you who are fairly new, relatively new, you really need to take to heart the things that you have to do before this proposal is submitted that are very important in terms of getting funding. This grant is heavily dependent on brownfield communities, the community itself. Maybe there's special considerations in that community, economic redevelopment zone, industry moving out, highly polluted, many brownfields, so that community assessment and its relationship to brownfields in that community is extremely important. Equally important, however, are employers in that community and the partnerships with those employers, because in the end, what this program is all about is getting jobs for disadvantaged, underserved populations, people in environmental jobs in brownfields communities. To do that, you need to have the employers on board. And I'm not saying that an employer has to commit to hiring your graduates. What he really needs to do, though, is commit to look at your graduates and see if there's a fit in his organization and what you're doing. And I often suggest that people work backwards. Certainly, they have to assess their community, look at the demographics to find out what's the best community to recruit your target population from. There certainly has to be brownfields, either cleanup or assessment grants in that community. But you also have to find out what are the employers that are involved in those activities, what kind of people are they looking for, what kind of people can they not hire because of the nature of their business. We find that many environmental contractors are very much open to hiring ex-offenders, and we've got some excellent programs such as Fortune Society that has an excellent job in training and placing ex-offenders. People have also indicated that in some parts of the country, it's very difficult to place ex-offenders. So you really have to find out from your employers. They really need to be working partners, as I said, working backwards to see who would be the key partners of your graduates, because this is a placement program, the type of people they're looking for, how those people fit into your demographic and your target group. And it may be callous, but job training programs are not heavily funded. We leverage them as much as possible. But you're only allowed with these funding levels maybe 20 students per cohort. Some way exceed that. Arch Hanks up in Northern California graduates a tremendous number of people. Some do less. But if you take 20 people, if you have a fairly large community, you might be whittling down 500 down to 20. And you can only accept 20 and or less, or maybe slightly more. But you have to find the most deserving students who have the best chance of succeeding in your program. And we'll talk about that later as we talk about recruitment strategies and how you go about doing that. So I said you have to line up all of your stakeholders. You need to get your team together this early because this does take time, and you probably should have done it by now, whether you have a grant writer. And if you're using a grant writer, which are very valuable, they need to definitely be in touch with project officer, the person that's going to be the director of the program, technical support, the trainers. You need to build your team. We've seen too often on failing programs that don't work, where a grant writer has written a great grant, they've received the money, but they have not involved the project officer that will be running the program, and all of a sudden he doesn't know what he's doing, he doesn't know what's expected, and the program just flounders. In addition, you've got to have the people who are going to be doing the work bring their insights into this and allow them to work with you as a team on how to respond to each of the RFP questions. So you've got to build your team internally of how you're going to do this. You've got to take that team and you've got to start developing your partnerships. And again, the most important partners are your employers, but equally important are your community organizations where you're going to be doing your recruiting from. You definitely have to try to get into city government, whether it's city council, the people who are involved in the cleanup efforts and the assessment efforts are either city, county, or state. Could be the deaner, the Department of Environmental Quality, which would be a state agency. The county government, in your case, if they're doing the work, but often it's city government. And the place to go there is the city Office of Economic Development and the mayor's office. And what you need to do is find out who's responsible for the Brownfields cleanup and assessment programs, and you need to go and see them and bring them in as partners. The more they could get into your program and bond with the program, the better off you're going to be. After you go through city government, which would be the first place to go, you need to expand to the county and then perhaps even the state, but definitely try to locate who your counterpart would be in city government, where the brownfields are, where the contractors are coming from. Too often, very often, very successful programs, they'll be sitting in on a city hall meeting in city hall, and they'll be right there with the contractors and the people in city government that are responsible for writing contracts with these individuals, and often will get commitments to look at your people because the contractors are looking for certified people to do this work. And if you could be sitting there being promoted by city government in front of contractors who are hoping to get the work, there's a very good chance that they'll, in one case, we had a Brownfields director sat in on one such meeting, and the six contractors said, well, we'll hire everyone you could produce. So these are the types of things you want to really start lining up early in the program. Very important, if you could find out who is doing the assessment and the cleanup grants, find out if they've held any public meetings. And if they haven't yet, you really need to see if you can get on the agenda for 5 minutes to announce your intentions to submit an environmental job training program that would be associated with their programs. One issue that we've come across are people are reluctant to commit themselves, and they don't want to be humiliated if they don't get the grant and go back and say, well, we didn't get the grant. But you need to do this. And if you don't get the grant, we find that often there might be other funding that's made available so you could start working. This is an annual program thus far with appropriations. It's happened every year for the last 15 years. So there's a very good chance that you might be able to get some planning funding or startup money from some discretionary source inside the government. So you could be planning and improve your grant and get the wheels rolling. In the worst case, you go back and say, well, we're not able to get this grant this year. We're working on it. We need to strengthen it, improve it. Talk to the regional coordinator, find out what the shortcomings of your grant were and fix them and be ready for the next year with your public meetings and your partnerships and your stakeholders. So many times grantees who don't make it the first year end up coming back and doing on the second year. And part of that reasoning is they really aren't prepared and haven't done all the homework that we've just talked about that first year. They get rejected, but by the second year, they've had plenty of time to line these programs up, make their public announcements, sit in on public meetings, make their contacts, and they've been able to proceed with a very strong proposal because they've established all of these. Don't forget your employers in addition to City Council. The closer you can get your employers to bond with your program, the much easier time you're going to have placing your graduates. Graduates in the right place to the right person can be extremely valuable. They may have up to $5,000 worth of certificates. Any employer who needs screened, trained, qualified, certified people is in his best interest to invest in your program. So I would approach potential employers as partners who you might ask to give lectures, talk about what they do, do awareness nights, do employer nights, as much as you can get out of them and bonding. The nice thing is when an employer comes and works with your program, he's eyeing up your students and graduates, and he may know before graduation who he would like to hire from your program. He may even give them a work study, may mentor them along, help them, give them some encouragement, maybe even say, well, if you keep well on this path, I got a slot for you. So you really want to get local employers into your program, not just as passive partners who know about your program. Also, those employers could provide you with letters of support and references. So again, the closer you get, one, to City Hall, to the ARC grants, which is the assessment. Revolving loan funds don't particularly have environmental jobs, but assessment and cleanup, that's ARC, assessment, revolving loan funds, and cleanup. So those assessment jobs and those cleanup jobs are where you're in brownfields. That's where you're going. Public meetings, getting your team together, getting in City Hall, getting your employers as close to you as possible. When you do that, it's not only your demographic general assessments that you can get on the computer, but as part of your labor market assessment, you want to name names, name companies. You want to come drill down as close to the jobs as possible. It makes your assessment so much better. There's the large general assessments are fine, but in the reality is the reviewers are looking where you're going to be. It's not how many jobs or what the projections of jobs are going to be. It's who is going to hire your graduates. Have they made commitments to look at your graduates? What kind of jobs are they? Are they associated with brownfields jobs? So you really need to make contact. Now you see why I'm doing this, preempting our discussion on recruitment, because it is just so important. And it does take a lot of time. And we are in early December, which gives us this month and just part of next month over Christmas holiday, which makes this difficult. So anyone on this call, I would start these in motion if it's not already there. If some of these parts are together, expand them, as we just discussed, so you can be ready to write a good proposal and have a good program. Later on, we'll talk about going to grants.gov and SAM. That takes some time, but not as much time as establishing these relationships. Well, I think that those are issues that will give you a good idea of what you need to be doing now if you're not. But let's spend a little time on recruitment strategies. This program is all about placing people in environmental jobs in brownfields, associated communities, all about placement. But all about placement means recruitment. You have to recruit people who can get these jobs. And you're working in a specific target group, which are all underserved, deserving people that need to have a chance. But you may have 500, you may have 100, you may have 80, all deserving people. Somehow you have to get that down to 20 of those people who are going to be the best candidates for success and employment in these environmental fields. It's kind of callous, a little bit heartless, but it's so important. Many of the failures that we have are often sometimes in rural communities, which makes them so hard. First-year grantees that are not known in the community, they don't have a large pool of people to assess. So they start bringing people in, they start marketing. They may have tremendous disparities in terms of education or motivation more so. And they're not, they end up with people dropping out, unmotivated, not hireable. And they've gone through all this work, and you've gone through all this work, and results are substandard. And it's all because of recruitment. So how do we get the best, most deserving students? And we definitely, and always part of those partnerships is the WIB. I call it the WIB, the local employment agency, state employment agency, the one-stop. WIOLA, this is a new workforce legislation that's passed. In any case, it's your basic state, city, or county employment agency. And it's so important. Everyone needs to be hooked up with them. One is you can qualify the applicants who are selected. If they qualify, they might be able to get boots, training materials, child care, maybe transportation. It varies from location to location, but they can provide, in some cases, employer incentive to hire your graduates. You need to find out what benefits they have if people qualify. You need to find out what services you can leverage from them. In most cases, they'll send you candidates. And often they will begin the preliminary screening of those candidates. They can do most of the analytical work. I break it down into two types of selection criteria. There's analytical, and then there's subjective. And analytical, we're talking about TAB tests, T-A-B tests. That's for tests for adult basic education. Some areas use work keys or CASAS. These measure the intellectual ability of the participants. Some of our grantees that don't have large selection may go to 8th grade. Many are 9th or 10th grade levels in terms of math and science, literacy levels, to successfully do this work. We find that when there are many candidates available, they may go to the 10th level, 10th grade. Some go to the 9th. But you can work with the Job Link Center and suggest that they send candidates that they feel deserving and they feel that would fit into this program through their interviews over to you for subjective testing. Now, I'm not saying that every grantee does this. Some of them do all this in-house by themselves very successfully. But if that organization exists in your community, it's a shame not to use it. And you really want to qualify them anyway. So I think it's a responsibility to get the participants who qualify every benefit you can. And that's part of working with the WIB or JobLink, whatever you might want to call it. But we find, even after those analytical tests, when we ask our grantees, what's the most important qualities that you need when you accept a person into your program? And one is sticking with the program, attending all the classes, probably at the top of the list, working well with groups, because one thing about environmental jobs is they're very group and team oriented. Outliers just don't appear to work on the job because you're working as teams. Passion for entering a new career, which would be this environmental career. If they're just sitting in that chair just to burn up time or something to do, it's not, if it's something they really don't want, don't waste their time and yours. They really have to be determined, because through this program they may have discouragements. Some of the material might be difficult. A lot will be fun, but this, there might be time when they question what they're doing. And they, last, as I've kind of said before, they have to appeal to the potential employer. You have to have a gauge or a feel for what employers are looking for. As one of the regional coordinators said, they observed some of the southern grantees. The employers were more reluctant to hire ex-offenders. Many of our programs, I think the one I really enjoy, like, is Fortune Society. They do an excellent job with ex-offenders, and they place them. And many of our programs have ex-offenders in their programs. Now, there's limitations on what kind of ex-offending offenses they can take, but you have to link that with your employers. And it's something you may want to do when you're surveying or talking to your employers, is do they have a reluctance to hire ex-offenders? And if so, what kind would they consider or not consider as part of your assessment? You don't want to, again, put everyone through this training and then find out that the jobs are not available. In a certain case, for example, this is a locality where marijuana is legal. You could go next door, buy marijuana legally, smoke it, go into the program, but you can't get a job because the employers won't hire those individuals. So while it may be legal, they're not placeable. So you really have to sort this out with your employers. Again, working backwards, when you develop your program policies, whether it's drug-free under any circumstance, ex-offenders to what extent, any of those issues. Some states, they can't, in a preliminary, it's the check-the-box issue where they can't determine whether they're ex-offenders or not until they get to the final part of the interview. So they could look at their capabilities and decide without prejudice if they would be good employees. So you need to get a feel for this early on, and you need to look at these subjective issues. What we recommend, and some people do everything I've just discussed in-house, but whether you use a WIB to funnel students in or whether you do your recruiting in-house, you need to do this intensive subjective evaluation. How is that done? Often they do with committees. We always suggest you do face-to-face. You've got to do face-to-face interviews. To the extent you do them, we've got grantees that go to the extent of interviewing the family, sitting down with the student applicant in the final stages, sitting down with the household, see if there are family issues or other issues, financial, transportation, health, that may be an issue, and not allow them to come to classes or not allow them to complete the program or be employed. So you need to get as close to that family as possible. Some of our grantees track their students forever, just about. They track them. They work with, and if they get in trouble, they'll go to court with them. It's a very personal relationship, and they're just part of the program. It's very important to have this face-to-face conversation, and certainly you need people on your staff who are working one-to-one with the students. So it's just not a matter of pushing people through a machine and then letting them go. This is more hands-on, working with them, working out their problems. Many problems will be more difficult in the training, following them, help nurturing them along when they're discouraged, picking them up, seeing if they need remedial training, see if there's some other help you can get them, usher them into a decent job, and maybe after they're on the job, help them out if they have some problems there. So this is a strategy that's also used and very important, and to the extent that you could get this into your grant in terms of your recruitment strategy would be very positive. We use all kinds of filtering techniques in our grants. Some do just what I said in terms of interviews and leave it at that. Again, all these strategies are filtering, going from a large number to a number that you feel that you can place. Some use tryouts. OAI has a very formalized tryout program where they actually have a large number of students go through many exercises, and that application process is difficult. And some will come to a awareness meeting and then not come to the second meeting. Others will not bother to fill out forms, or it's too hard, or they don't want to spend the time, so they drop out. And it's one way of filtering the students down. If they're not willing to jump the hoops, fill out the forms, or go to additional meetings, how are they going to attend the classes? So this is all part of this filtering process. They go to the extent of actually doing work and in a tryout period where they're kind of selected like a little league team. Another thing that's kind of like a tryouts or little league team is what many of our exemplary programs do is they may have a construction program. And I know we have people on the call that have construction programs and are considering adding environmental onto it. If you have a construction program, and it could be some other type program, life skills program, it could be some other type of transportation program, you start running your students through that program, giving them those skills. Now, that's not supported by this grant, but can be supported by some other program. Then you go into that program, and you're close to the students, and you start cherry-picking, basically, finding out if some of those people would like added credentials and added environmental credentials that would make them much more valuable, not only in construction skills, but also have environmental certifications that only they could do. And there are many jobs where people have construction ability but no credentials in the environment and can't work on the job. The person most valuable is that person that has to work on the site requiring certifications, HAZWOPR, for example. They have construction skills. They've gone through first aid training. They've done all of the pre-training. And in addition to that, they have environmental certs that allow them to go on the sites or do the environmental remediation. And that's an excellent way to do it because you know they've had the endurance and perseverance to go through the construction program, and you're going to be adding additional burden onto their time. It's going to take additional time and workload to do the environmental education. But having gotten that, they have credentials both in construction, health and safety, and in environmental remediation. So those, we find those programs are excellent, and it's a matter of tacking your environmental program onto an existing training program, picking or offering the best students a chance to go on to this advanced environmental training. And those of you who can link up, partner with, you don't have to have it in your program if you've got a strong partner, link up with one of these training programs and be involved with them in a partnership. It's a great recruitment and screening tool to have. Again, we're going in this big filter from rough screen and awareness nights to applications, to interviews, to multiple interviews, to home visits, to subjective discussions, to pre-training and perhaps tryouts. And as you see, what I'm saying is we're going from very general, very larger populations to a very small group of 20 or so people that will be your applicants. And of course, if you do this, you're going to have an excellent retention rate. You'll have employable graduates. You're going to be involving your employers. So what it'll end up with placement rates that we've had as high as 100%. It takes a lot of effort up front and a lot of nurturing, but it makes for an excellent program, both for the students that are in your program, for the employers, and for you as being the program director. This is much easier to do in areas with large population. As you get into smaller, more rural areas, it's more difficult because you've got larger disparities, less people to draw from, smaller communities, and it becomes more of a challenge. And in those cases where you're particularly the first year when you don't have a lot of applicants, you have to make your recruitment and your marketing upfront, more emphasis on that. And you need to, in those cases, work with community groups, religious organizations to recommend, and high schools to recommend people in the community that they feel would be really good and benefit from this program. And again, to the extent that more that come into the program, the more you can filter, the higher your success rate is going to be. Well, having said this, all of you have lots to do before the January due date. We're going to be talking about this some more on the 16th of December. In addition, we're going to be talking about student services retention and then that whole idea of placement. And between now and then, if you have any questions, you can email me, msenew@aol.com, msenew@aol.com, or glohannah, ghanne, at eicc.edu with questions. We do have a listserv, and we have our PLC list. The PLC list is, if you've been getting notice and post-session notes, you don't have to do anything. You're on the list until you ask to be taken off. We'll send you post-session notes, and you can send any questions in, and we'll address them at the next PLC session. We try to limit these conversations to 30 minutes. Again, next week we're going to do one, then we're going to skip over the holidays before it's due, and then we'll probably take a little break and then start up again every other week, even after the grant proposals are due, just to talk about developing a program, what to do after the grant has been proposal been set in, what other strategies you could do between now and when your grant is accepted. So thanks for tuning in, and you'll be getting post-session notes. We'll talk about these items in more detail and some addresses and some grant opportunities that have popped up, environmental justice grant program opportunities, and certainly we'll inform you about the ARC grants, which you need to get in touch with. So between now and then, I hope everyone has a good session tomorrow with Joe from EPA. He delivers an excellent webinar. Thank you again.